Okay, everyone, welcome to the first of the VFX online town halls, session one, State of the Industry. And let me just see if this works. Look at this. My slide thing is working, so it looks like we're in good shape. I want to thank everyone for being in attendance and for all the interest in this. And we'll be talking about our panelists in a second, but I also want to give special thanks to Harry Sherman, who designed the poster, and to Ryan and to the people at WebEx.com who made this technically possible tonight. WebEx, when I did some research, WebEx was the, everyone said, was the leader in doing this sort of large-scale conferencing the right way, and they've just been tremendously helpful since I talked to them last week, so I want to give a huge thank you to them. Okay. I want to give a quick idea on tonight's schedule. My name is Lee Stranahan, and I'll be talking about me and everyone else in a second. We're going to start with introductions. I'm going to have a brief section about the town halls in general. Then we'll get on to tonight's presentation on the state of the industry. And then we're going to have a lot of time for audience Q&A. I'm planning about half the time for audience Q&A. So when we get to the state of the industry part, I'll talk for a brief little bit. And then we'll turn it over to our panelists tonight, Chris, Scott, and Jeff. They will each talk for, I would say, 5 to 10 minutes just to give sort of an opening statement. And then we'll go straight to Q&As because the point of this whole thing is to get the community talking. So let's just start with the introductions for tonight. My name is Lee Stranahan. As I mentioned, I'm a featured writer at the Huffington Post website. I've taught filmmaking and visual effects for about 20 years. I worked for the past 5 years. I left about a year ago for NBC broadcast. I worked for a TV show called Access Hollywood as a motion graphic artist. And prior to that, I've done visual effects work for clients like Fox and HBO. And I've been involved in digital visual effects for about 20 years since my use of an Amiga computer, which will tell you something. I'll be moderating tonight. And also helping me moderate is Jeff Huser. Jeff is a visual effects artist and supervisor who's worked with facilities like Digital Domain, The Orphanage, and Troika, among many, many others. He's the co-chancellor of the great FX PhD program at FXPhD.com that you may know about. And he's also one of the hosts of FX Guide. And Jeff has been tremendously helpful in helping get the word out about this. As someone who's not moderating tonight, but I saw him in the audience, Bran from Motionographer, and also Eric Alba, who I don't know if he's here tonight, but he's been a great help. But Jeff is going to be helping me get your questions out. If everyone who's attending looks at the screen, over on the right, there's a part that says chat. I can't see. I'm not looking at that. And then there's a part that says Q&A. And as we go through, if you have questions, you can type them in there. Jeff and I will be looking through your questions, and then when we get to the Q&A part, we'll be pulling them out and asking questions of the panelists. If you want a question for a specific panelist, please, when you type in the Q&A, say, you know, for Jeff Okun, for Scott Ross, or, you know, for everybody, and then ask your question. If you have something you really feel is important that you talk through, not just ask a text question, state that, and I will try to get you online as a panelist so you can actually ask your question over audio. And you can do that from anywhere in the world, and I know we have people attending from all over the world tonight. Our three panelists tonight, Chris DeFaria is the Vice President of Visual Effects and Animation at Warner Brothers Pictures, and has a tremendous amount of experience as a executive, as a producer, and working with some of the top visual effects films for the Chris, Warner Brothers is the number one film studio in the world right now, correct? Is Chris there?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yeah. Warner Brothers is the number one studio, right?
Last year we were in, the year before.
Okay, there you go. So that's pretty good. And we're tremendously glad to have Chris with us tonight. Our second panelist is Jeffrey A. Okun. Jeff is the chair of the Visual Effects Society, and he's a longtime visual effects supervisor and coordinator with a tremendous number of credits. I just listed a couple, but he's worked on a lot of films. And we'll talk about his role in a second here. And finally, we are really privileged to have Scott Ross with us tonight. Scott is the co-founder of Digital Domain, former general manager of Industrial Light and Magic, VP at Lucasfilms. And I could absolutely not be more pleased with the panel that we have tonight. And one thing that I should mention up front is that everybody's opinions tonight, just get this out of the way, are their own opinions and not that of their company or organization. If Jeff Okun is saying something, if there's an official VES position, he can differentiate that. But generally, same with Chris. Scott is in an interesting position because Scott is the guy who's really been around, especially since the digital visual effects revolution, from the beginning, working with major facilities. But Scott has been out of the visual effects world for about 3 or 4 years. And therefore, Scott is in the unusual position of he's definitely not speaking for any company or organization because he's not working with one. So that and the fact that he's a New Yorker means that Scott will be unusually honest tonight, probably. So let me talk briefly about the town halls and the idea behind them. This sort of got started a few weeks ago when I published a piece in the Huffington Post called An Open Letter to James Cameron about fairness for the visual effects industry. And I was sort of talking in a large-scale sense about the problem that I hadn't really heard anybody in the mainstream press talk about. Over at Huffington Post, I usually post about politics. I do comedy and some entertainment stuff, but usually it's a politics that I talk about over there. And because I've worked in visual effects and a lot of my friends work in visual effects, my brother Ken works in visual effects, it's an issue I know something about, which is the general issue, and we'll talk about this question in a second, but the general issue of everyone knows that visual effects are key to filmmaking now, but a lot of people outside the industry don't really know how the industry works. And so the idea behind these town halls, what happened was after I wrote that article, and I write about 2 pieces a week for Huffington Post usually. And after I wrote that article, I had a lot of people sort of emailing me and saying, okay, Lee, that was great. What's next? And I said, well, what do you mean? What's next? I just wrote an article. And people were like, okay, but what are we going to do now? And, you know, that's sort of unusual. Usually I write a piece and, you know, that's it. It's tomorrow's fish and chip paper is what they say. And but this one, there was a resonance. A lot of people ask what was going to happen. And so I put together this first town hall. Harry, who made the poster, is a guy I worked with at Access Hollywood. So I sort of wrote to Harry. I said, I think I need a poster. And then I reached out to Jeff, Scott, and Chris about being on the panel. And the general idea behind all these town halls is to start discussions about these important issues with everybody. And that's why I'm glad we have so many people represented tonight, from journalists to in the trenches, hands-on buttons, visual effects workers to supervisors and people all over the world. This is the first town hall. I'm planning to do more town halls in the future to discuss things like labor issues, international competition, the games industry, and other topics. But tonight, I wanted specifically to talk about the state of the industry and to give people sort of a large-scale view of where we are. And the big question that I talked to a journalist on a Friday night, and she asked a great question, and I'm paraphrasing it, but she basically said, why is it that we're in a world where visual effects films are doing so well, while visual effects facilities and the artists that work in them are struggling? And, you know, we had a couple facilities go out of business in the last couple weeks. And I think that is the question that a lot of people who work in VFX have. And so just to give some background on this, this is a list I put together from Box Office Mojo of the world's 10 top grossing films. And if you just scroll down the list, you know, Avatar, Titanic, Lord of the Rings, and so on, the Pirates movies, the Harry Potter movies, right? These 10 films, all told, made, I added this up, they made, I think that's $11 billion. I think it's $11.5 billion. There's a lot of zeros there, so it confuses me. But I think, I believe that number is $11 billion between those top 10 films worldwide gross. And I put together a little chart that may be helpful to understand this about what genre all those films fit into. And so here's a little pie chart I put together, which is the top grossing films in the world, 100% of them are visual effects films, every single one. And so if I had listed the top 20 grossing films of all times, by the way, they're also all visual effects films. There's a couple Star Wars films in there and more Harry Potter and that kind of thing. But every single one of these films is a visual effects film. And so to me, this leads to the tough question that we'll be asking of our three panelists tonight in general, which is, aside from where they see the state of the industry right now, is what do they believe can be done to create an industry where everyone thrives? And my short take on this, which I will just get out of the way as moderator, is that I don't think that there are simple answers to this, which is why we're doing these town halls as opposed to wrapping everything up in a couple of short phone calls. I think that the visual effects industry, particularly the digital visual effects industry, is young and immature, and that's part of the problem. And I don't mean that the people are young and immature, because a lot of them are middle-aged now. They may have started as 20, 25-year-olds, but now they have mortgages and kids and everything else. But the industry itself, compared to a lot of other disciplines in film, is young and relatively immature. Another take of mine on this is that the industry rises and falls together. And this goes with the fourth point, that I don't view this as a supervillains thing. I really appreciate having people like Chris on the call talking from a studio perspective. I don't view the studios as the enemy here for a simple reason. If they stop making visual effects films, there's no more industry. I also don't view the facilities as the supervillain here. And I definitely don't view the artist as the supervillains here, although I will say, even with the artist, sometimes there are unrealistic expectations on the artist's part. And I think that everybody, if we look at the ecosystem here, the studios represented by Chris, the facilities represented by Scott, and the artists represented by Jeff. And I put the facilities right in the middle because really the artists seldom deal directly with the studios. Really the relationship is the studios deal with the facilities and the facilities hire the artist. But I think if any one of these things goes out, we all go out. There's no visual effects industry with only two of these. You need all three of these in order to thrive and survive. And so that's sort of why we put the panel together the way we did tonight, and that's a general overview. What's at stake here? I would say the future of filmmaking, so no pressure, guys. And what I mean by that is that I think Avatar really proved this. Visual effects used to be the domain of post-production. Visual effects are something that got added in post. Then in the past few years, especially, although this goes back even 20 years ago, I did a couple of days of consulting in Jurassic Park where they were trying to figure out how to use computers for previs. And at the time, it was sort of limited what you could do. And now computers are obviously computers and visual effects and the artists that run them. It's not just computers, but the people that run them are obviously a part of the pre-production process. The thing that I think happened with Avatar is that in more of a way than we've seen before, visual effects are actually part of the production process. They're involved day of the shoot, where Cameron had his editing system on the stage and was working with things directly in production. And I interviewed one of the visual effects supervisors for Avatar, And he talked about how, Stephen Rosenbaum, he talked about how they had a word for it, which was basically like pre-pro-production or something like that. It was all the words strung together. And that's why I think the issues of the visual effects industry are really the issues of the entire U.S. filmmaking industry and the worldwide filmmaking industry. Obviously, all of our panelists are from the U.S., even though they work internationally. But I think that what we're talking about here is who's going to control the future of filmmaking and how healthy will that future be. So without any further ado, I'm going to start to turn it over to our panelists. I'm going, just so everyone knows, the order I'm going in is Scott. I introduced everybody alphabetically, but I'm going to have Scott start, then Chris, then Jeff. And I'm just going to have Scott start because, again, representing the facilities, he's the person in the middle. And I thought he would give a good perspective on things. So, Scott, you ready?
As I ever was.
Okay, there we go. Any, by the way, let me just stop before you start. Any questions? Anything I need to clear up before we move forward? Anything? Any famous last words?
Good here.
Me?
I'll take that. Yeah, go ahead.
Is Jeff Huser supposed to be speaking as well?
He could be. Why? Did he, is something wrong?
Oh, no, he just need to, you need to promote him to panelist. So he can...
I got dropped out again, Lee.
Well, I can hear you.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, but I don't see any of the questions going by is what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm not promoted to the panel thing. So.
He's back in. Just need to promote him back to panelist.
So I will. Thanks a lot, Ryan. I appreciate it. See, this is why WebEx is so awesome. So what I'm going to do is do that while Scott talks. How's that?
Thanks, Lee. I appreciate it. First of all, let me thank everybody for attending tonight, and particularly the panelists that are sitting virtually next to me. These two guys have really made a major impact on the industry in the last 15 years or so. And it's funny, when you start talking about the industry as young and immature, I'd like to consider myself very old and immature. So I feel that I fit in sort of to the industry. My career has been interesting in that I came about in the days when we were moving from optical into digital at Industrial Light and Magic, and the world changed very much on that day. And it continues to change, and some might say for the better. You know, we look at the films, and the films are more exciting than ever. Last night I was sitting down in Venice having dinner, and I turned to the TV, and there on the plasma was Titanic, and I'm looking at the composite shots, and I'm shuddering, and I feel like I need to call Rob Legato on the phone. The images have increased and have become much more magical every single year. And even while that magic continues to happen, and box office continues to soar, and directors are making 10% of first dollar gross or 15% of first dollar gross, and studios on their big tentpole movies are doing very, very well, facilities continue to not do very well. And I think that is a matter of a carryover over the years when there was not enough work and there were too many facilities. And additionally, oftentimes, at least in the early days, facilities were not managed by people that managed facilities. They were generally founded by people who were visual effects artists and or directors, and they started shops to supplement their creative visions, but without very much management training, without very many managerial types within the business. And as the business started to explode and capital equipment became more and more and more expensive, and the studios, in my opinion, doing the job that they're trying to do, which is to make the best pictures for the least amount of money, as production costs have also soared, continue to look for innovative ways to be able to do things. I think Chris has said in the past, I've listened to some of the panels that he's been on in preparation, and it's, you know, sort of the role of the visual effects studio is to innovate. And while visual effects studios have innovated in a very big way in terms of their technical capabilities and innovated in terms of the images that are put up on the screen, oftentimes, there hasn't been very much innovation in terms of management, project management, process, managing the client, managing the director. And as a result of that, what's happened, I believe, is that while, you know, we're looking at movies with thousands of effect shots and budgets that are far in excess of what the gross revenue of Industrial Light and Magic used to be back in the 80s and early 90s, there still isn't any money being made. I think that's hard for a lot of people to be able to grasp and hard for people to understand. But the margins that exist within the visual effects industry are generally non-existent. That means very little, and more often than not, no net profit at the end of the day. And as a result of that, very difficult to be able to invest in the things that we so desperately need, in the things that will make the workplace a better place. You know, when I was at Industrial Light and Magic back in the 80s, as Apple Computer took off, a lot of the employees that were working at ILM were saying, well, why can't we have a gym? And why can't we have a cafeteria? And why can't we have childcare? And why can't we have? And the reason we couldn't have, while George had made the money that he had made, George Lucas had made the money that he made on Star Wars, by the time I was there, George was hardly involved in the business. You know, I think I saw him maybe 4 or 5 times in the years that I worked there. And so Industrial Light and Magic was responsible for its own P&L, responsible for its own cash flow, and responsible for its own bottom line. And there were many years where Industrial Light and Magic didn't make any money. And it was very, very difficult competing in the Bay Area and looking at your employee base and knowing full well that at the end of the day, it was really the folks that were creating the images, not management, not the owners, but the folks that were creating the images were the people that were making the magic and was bringing the work in. But we as management, because there was no money available to us, the best thing we could hope for is to hold on to our staff, keep them employed, give them paychecks, make sure that the paychecks didn't bounce, which I'll tell you, at Digital Domain, we never bounced a paycheck, but there were moments, you know, very difficult moments when cash was down to a very, very de minimis amount. And we were concerned that as we put out our payroll, that people would not get paid. So the combination of all that and what's happened with the international segment as well, where work is now flowing outside of California, outside of the United States, outside of, you know, Great Britain and Australia and New Zealand, and now flowing into places like India and Vietnam and the Philippines and China, we're starting to see even more dire competition where it's very difficult to keep shops open and shops continue to close. And so I look at the facilities owners as an ex-facilities owner and saying, I think the sensibility of who we are and what we offer has to change. I gave a speech about 3 months ago for Pearson, the people that own the Financial Times Network. And I was speaking about visual effects, and a fellow in the back who's an MBA raised his hand, and he said, so it sounds like you're a commodities industry. I said, absolutely not. We're the furthest thing from commodities. In fact, we are the people that put the butts in the seat. If you look at the trailers are chock full of visual effects. It's no longer about Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise. It's really about flooding New York or, you know, flying birds with blue people on them. That's what it's about. And he said, oh, okay. And I said, and it really has difficult barriers to entry. There are very, very few people that can put through thousands of shots on a movie of the quality that some of these houses do. They said, okay. And then he finally turned to me, he said, but your pricing and the way in which you get paid seems to be that you're a commodity. And I raised my voice a little bit, and I said, we are not a commodity. He says, well, if it smells like a commodity and it looks like a commodity, it's a commodity. And that's the way visual effects facilities price their services. And they do it because the concern, and I look at it from this point of view, the concern is that when you build a big visual effects facility, it's like being an airline. You've bought all of these planes. You have all of these stations at all of these international airports. Your overhead is astronomical. And if the planes don't take off and there are no butts in the seats, then you're losing a lot of money. Maybe I'll make a number up. Maybe you're losing $100 a seat. But if you sell it for $80 a seat, you're only losing $20 a seat. And so what happens is visual effects facilities low bid to be able to get the work. And because the production pipeline is so helter-skelter and turnarounds are not addressed and credits are not addressed and the way in which the work process is done is not addressed, that the problem is the more people we throw at it, the more expensive it becomes. The more shots that are added, the more expensive it becomes. But oftentimes, facilities owners would rather have the airplanes in the air losing money than the airplanes on the ground losing a ton of money. And so that's where I see where the problem comes from. 18, by the way, of the 22 Visual Effects Academy Awards since I've been in the business, 18 of the 22 years I've been in the business have all gone to big visual effects house, 18 of 22. And so I look to the big visual effects companies and say, I think it's time to be able to address our process, the way in which we work, the pipeline, set rules, set direction, work more closely with the studio, help to control the director, and price things accordingly. Because now is the time, and our industry is really in dire straits. And I'm hopeful that with this effort and other efforts to come, that we're going to pull this together in a way on an international basis, because after all, it is an international business, and hold hands together, figure out a way, and not do it with paranoia and fear, but do it with openness and full heart, and do it correctly.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Scott.
You're welcome.
And a lot of questions are coming in already. Next up, Chris Tafari from Warner Brothers.
Hello, and thank you, everybody, for joining this. So, Scott, listen, much of what you said, I think it provides absolutely the proper framework for discussions tonight. It inevitably becomes a conversation about business and business practices, and it can sort of quickly go there, and I have a feeling most of the conversation tonight will be about that. But before we get too far down the path, I want to go back to the villain thing that we started with, which is that there are no villains in this, and I'm saying that kind of half-heartedly or jokingly because, you know, I think it's important to realize that, and I'm speaking from the studio, we are, you know, we're the ones that spend the money, we're the ones that demand innovation, we're the ones that take the risks, and most important, and I think for this conversation, is we're the ones who are deeply invested in a thriving, competitive visual effects environment, not just price competitive, but competitive in terms of artistry and innovation. So I come into this conversation and come into every day at work with that in mind, not with the idea of, gee, what can we do to make it more difficult for the people I consider and the companies I consider as partners in making these enormous films. I think there's a couple trends that are worth noting here. I think the good news in talking about the state of the industry is that visual effects, at least in terms of its role in films, is growing. There's simply more work being done. More high-quality work being done. Visual effects is central to marketing. It's, as pointed out by Scott, it's in all the trailers. It's also central to internal marketing at the studios. It's what we, you know, I often use to gain momentum or add value to a project that's languishing and isn't, you know, getting its footing at the studio. We might go create, you know, commonly called a test, but it's beyond that now. We actually do look development. We do technical development. We try and land something, bring something in that the studio heads have never seen before, show it to them, and then out of that, you know, the pictures gain real momentum within the studio. I think the bad news, though, aside from those, is that it goes back to where we're talking about commodity, commoditization. Something I think I've talked about, for those of you that were at the VFX event this past year, we got into a conversation about this, but it still is an important. And despite the fact that we've talked about it and Scott talked about it, it's a very important concept for everyone to get their head around because the most important or among the most important things that happen when something is begin to be viewed as a commodity is that brands lose value. I mean, it can be good for the consumer, but it can be terrible for the business. And I do think we're in a period right now of commoditization of what before was a very unique and valued art, and that is, you know, the art of creating the impossible, the visual effects. I think that... The other bit about the bad news, I guess, for me is the other thing that Scott mentioned, which is this notion of innovation. And again, I see tremendous innovation in technical. I don't see innovation in the business models. The visual effects business, when we get into that conversation, I mean, it's tough. It's tough because I don't know how, when someone says, how can the studios be making this much money or these films be performing at this level, yet the visual effects, which are so central and critical to it, these companies are not making money. They're barely staying in business. That's a sign of an unhealthy business. I don't know what one does to fix that except for to fall back on what are rather traditional and very commonly, not commonly misunderstood, business practices. We have to, the pricing has to reflect value. Right now it doesn't. Right now pricing reflects a marketplace, and a very aggressive marketplace fueled by new companies coming in, companies with, either if they don't have direct state support, they're operating in a very tax incentive-rich environment. There's, subsidized pricing throughout the planet. I don't know how a company, let's just talk about any of these companies, but particularly those that are not based in a tax incentive-rich environment, can possibly compete. It's virtually, it's just unimaginable to me that what we're currently, the incentives that are placed in somewhere like Canada, I don't know how another company or business could compete with that. So, but I think throughout, even then, even setting aside the subsidies, I do think there's a problem with the pricing. And I think that's something Scott mentioned. I think it's worth talking about whether there are new models here for pricing the work or recognizing the value, and, of course, innovations in business models that can somehow arrive at what commonsensically would feel like a healthier business, one where these companies that I recognize right here are incredibly important to a company like Warner Brothers, can remain in business. Because, again, when I started this short little conversation is that, I'm deeply invested in this, in these companies doing well. Without visual effects companies, visual effects artists, obviously we can't deliver our films, and we're in a much worse position than we would be simply making a good deal. I think I'll leave it at that. Look forward to sort of the questions that come from this.
Okay, that's great, Chris. Thanks very much. And finally, let's talk to Jeff Okun.
Hey there. Just like that?
Jeff, you're on. Yeah, you're on.
All right. Well, first, let me state that, of course, I have to do this because my board members made it clear. I'm not reflecting any opinions of the Visual Effects Society. Everything you hear is Jeff Okun. So when you get angry at me. Secondly, I want to thank you for throwing this. I'm really honored to be here with Chris DeFaro and with Scott Ross, two people I respect tremendously. Now, the issue here is, as I understand it, based on what I've been reading from the open letter, is everybody is, and by everybody I mean artist, is all flustered and busy about the work hours, the lack of pay, that there's no, bonuses involved in things, and isn't our lives horrible, and things like that, and that the studios are the villains in this because they make all the money, and they're not giving it to anybody. And I've had a number of conversations with both Chris and Scott, not specifically in regards to this, but each one of them makes a very valid point. And the valid point is, in fact, that the studios aren't in business to keep us artists in business. They're in business to manufacture a product that generates money. And there's a certain amount of personal responsibility that the artist is required to take. Yes, unpaid overtime, yes. A certain amount of responsibility that the artists are required to take for themselves, in that, you can stand up for yourself. You can join together and go to the union and say, we need representation. We want a visual effects union, or we want a visual effects guild. What I've noticed as the chair of the VES is a lot of people are really good at whining and complaining and not really good at providing solutions. And we kind of have a rule inside the society that says you can criticize anything, but you have to throw out a solution, even if it's a goofy one, because it gets the conversation going. And so on that basis, my hat's off to you, Lee, for starting this conversation. Now, when it comes to the business end of everything, I think by the end of tonight, everyone's going to agree that it's actually not the studios and it's not the artists, but it's the facilities. And I think if we all take a massive leap backwards in time to when Scott Ross was involved in helping to create the VES, albeit a different VES than the one we have today, I think that something that he was sort of crucified for back then now would be welcomed with open arms, when what he tried to accomplish, whether he put it in these words or not, were that we need representation on a business level, that if our businesses, meaning the facilities, weren't so dadgummed busy trying just to keep the doors open and meet their payroll, but actually could conduct business in a way that afforded them just a moment to glance back at the people driving the machine, the people with their fingers on the keys and building the pipelines and the infrastructures and all that stuff, and get into what they need to support, you know, I think that they would be happy, and they should be happy to throw whatever cash they need in order to make it a survivable thing, because it's to nobody's advantage that the artists are abused and used up and then tossed out. But part of my speech that I give to the VES is that you have to look back 30 years to the beginning of the digital age, and even though it wasn't really digital then, it was photochemical. And you look back to how we marketed ourselves as a visual effects industry back then, and the words that come to mind are geeks, not artists, and that look at what my cool computer does, not look at what I can do. And if writers marketed themselves that way, and editors marketed themselves that way with the digital age, you know, it's like nobody cares who the editor is because it's the Avid that's doing the editing, and nobody cares who the writer is because it's the, you know, the Mac PowerBook or the you know, Windows, whatever they are, that are doing the writing. So for 30 years, visual effects artists have been sending out the wrong message. And part of what the VES is about is trying to change the perception of what we are from geeks into artists, and try and get people to recognize that, and trying to get people to follow artists, whether they go from facility to facility or not, and get some value onto the individual. And that we're also, we meaning me, not the VES, but we also feel strongly that besides a professional honorary organization, which is what the VES is, there's a need for a trade organization. There's a need for a guild or a union. And I know from, you know, various conversations with various other studio people that they're not necessarily against this. It might make their lives a heck of a lot easier because they know what they're getting into, and there could be a certification system so they know who they're hiring and things like that. So the conversation tonight, you know, as much as I would love to make it about all the abuses that are heaped on the artists, but with Chris DeFaro here and with Scott Ross with an amazing overview here, you know, with Lee and myself here, I really think that we're going to have to put the finger on facilities and facility reputations, because they're the ones who are providing the environment for which we do the work, and they're the ones who talk to the artists, and they're the ones who talk to the studios. So I'll conclude my little opening remarks with that, and over to you guys.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Let me actually start by picking up on something that Jeff got into a little bit there. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a visual effects supervisor, and he's been reading a lot of books lately on the labor movement in Hollywood as it developed, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And one thing that he mentioned is that any of the advances that came along also came with a degree of sacrifice. So the example he used was when the Writers Guild was formed. And what he said was, and again, this is secondhand, so if I'm getting anything wrong, I apologize. But what he said basically was that when the writers organized into the Writers Guild, one of the things they gave up, for instance, was copyright. The writer is not the author of a film. Currently, the studio who owns it is technically the author of the film. And if you're a writer, copyright's a pretty big deal. So
his point was that it wasn't just like they got together and took a vote and didn't give up anything and suddenly, yay, we have a guild. That they actually had to make, you know, sacrifices, in some cases pretty big ones, in terms of a longer term gain. So I'll just sort of throw that, I'll just throw that concept out to everyone on the panel if anyone has any comments on that.
Let's see, this is Chris talking. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Just listening to that, I mean, the equation you have there between, you know, achieving something, giving up something, sure, that of course exists. I'm trying to think of that equation and how it could apply here. You know, Jeff and I have talked independently about, well, creating a union, would a union be, or a guild be, an answer to this? Certainly it could address some of the things that Jeff has raised in terms of the employer-employee relationship, because really the artists work for facilities, certainly not for the studios necessarily. I think there's a number of problems that come with that, not the least of which is that, you know, you're dealing with one of the just increasingly global environment here. I'm not sure how you would organize that in a way that could, you know, borrowing from any of the other guilds or unions that have been created in the entertainment business, might be a bit of a problem. The other side, the other point I really wanted to make was that in the equation that you're describing here, authorship, ownership, you know, which might equate to the idea of copyright, I actually think those might be the most valuable thing in the very, they might provide a way out of the mess that we're describing here. Because, again, going back to this notion of commodity, the one thing that I think is missing, and it is something Jeff alluded to, this idea that, you know, technology has been sold, that a company like the is essentially what is being hired as opposed to the artists there. I try and go out of my way to learn the artists that are working on some of our more important work. It's very hard to do. It's seemingly impenetrable sometimes to deal with the larger houses. Because it's not in their interest, really, to have individual artists recognized. It's in their interest to have the organization recognized. I think that might be short-sighted. You look at how a successful commercial production company works, and it's the directors that are put forward. It's the artists that you're hiring. To get them, you go through that company. So as much as the idea that you would trade away maybe something, the thing I wouldn't trade away to try and solve this problem, in fact, I would do the opposite, is to try and increase the obvious and clear connection between someone's work and the artist who did it, so that people that are in positions like myself would say, much as we do with a supervisor, but extend it down through all the artists, say, you know, I need the guys, I want to work with those people, that group, that team, the set of character animators, that set of, the guys that wrote those shaders, whatever the commodity or the product that we're going after is.
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that. This is Scott. To an extent, you know, as you look, as I made that comment before, 18 of the 22 visual effects Oscars went to big houses. I also find it interesting there have been visual effects supervisors that have worked with big houses that have won Academy Awards, and leaving the big eight, as it were, have never won an Academy Award again. It's slightly different than a director in a commercial production company in that it really takes a gigantic team effort to be able to do this work and to do it at the level that we all do it at. And so it's an MIS department, and it's a software department, and a technology group. And, you know, there's just so much behind. It's sort of like taking Joe Montana back in the day and putting him in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They're still going to be a terrible football team at that time. You really need the support of so many people nowadays, particularly in the size of the shows that are being put forth.
Jeff, do you have anything on that?
No.
No. I don't. Okay, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. So let me take it over. Let's start with the audience questions. Jeff Huser, do you have anyone you want to start with?
Well, people were asking questions like about, you know, how facilities can cannot be making money and what the margins are. Is one thing I noticed.
Scott, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, they don't make money because the incredible overhead. I think I've heard numbers like 75 to 80% of an overall facility's overhead is personnel. The way in which people were paid and how they got paid was considerable. You know, you look at the growth of the pay scale, it's been astronomical. And I thought it was interesting, you know, as a new studio, a visual effects studio would start up, we would see pay scales increase 15, 20, 30, 50%, sometimes 100%, because a large-scale studio would be interested in doing projects of the highest caliber, and so they'd need talent. And so they would have to go to the existing studios that had talent and offer them credible contracts and deals. And so, you know, salary rates increased incredibly during the 90s. Capital equipment costs are astronomical. While the cost of each computer has gone down, the number of computers are so much more. And the amount of technology needed to do the work. I remember when we started Digital Domain, we went out and bought, I think there was three terabytes or something in the initial stages of the company. And I was talking to the folks at Weta now, and the numbers are astronomical. I forget the name of what's beyond a terabyte, a decabyte, I don't know. But the number of amount of memory and the amount of terminals and the amount of computers is astronomical as well. And now add to that the overall infrastructure and the management of it. So margins in the visual effects business are generally non-existent. We have very little back-end participation, if any, and we're paid generally because of a bid, which is oftentimes along the big houses. It's not necessarily low bid wins, but it's definitely competitive bid wins, and oftentimes that's competitive to the point that visual effects studios know before they're going in that there's a likelihood that they're not going to make any money on the show. And then add to the fact the amount of changes that happens on a show and the inability to be able to really manage the production process, because at the end of the day, you know, we're driving a cab. The director gets in and says, I want to go to 42nd Street and Broadway, and you say the West End Highway has got a traffic jam, and he says, shut up, and you can't start the meter. You just have to drive. And so visual effects facilities are put in a position whereby they're not making any money. They're charging money, sometimes tens of millions of dollars, for the work that they're doing. But when all is said and done with costs and overhead, infrastructure, et cetera, there's nothing left on the bottom line.
Anyone else want to talk on that one? I'll take that as a no. Okay, let's. I want to take a question from Rebecca Keegan, who asks, "Is there any effort afoot to get tax incentives in the U.S. for the visual effects industry?"
It's Chris. I can sort of handle a bit of that question. I mean, there are incentives in the United States in place that are extended to visual effects work. Unfortunately, they're not really in places where there's a lot of visual effects infrastructure. So any of the incentive state incentives that are in place, the most notable ones being Louisiana, New York, Massachusetts, they're pretty aggressive, and North Carolina, and they would extend to visual effects work done there. We've entertained scenarios of starting companies, moving into existing small companies and trying to build them out to avail ourselves of the tax deals there, partnering with existing companies to set up there, much as Sony has done in New Mexico. The New York, of course, does have infrastructure in place. There isn't a shop there, you know, that's of the size of the ones in California. So they do exist in the United States. But they just, all of them have problems. None of them are as generous as those can be found just, you know, outside our borders.
Hey, Chris, this is Jeff Fuser. Isn't also a lot of those starting to, I mean, I know Australia recently, didn't they just decline to increase theirs to match some of these other places? And isn't Massachusetts in trouble? Isn't the governor trying to repeal those?
Oh, yeah, and we have instances where, yeah, I don't, we have instances where it's difficult to collect as well in certain states. Yeah, I don't know that the I want to say this carefully. I don't see how those really work out in the end, because you know there's a lot of money changing hands there, and I'm sure for certain situations in certain states it makes no sense at all, and they find that out very quickly. But then it's very successful. You know, Australia, you point out, which has currently a 15% back for any expenditure over $5 million. And if the film qualifies as a Australian content film, which has a set of, you know, subjective and some objective criteria, you know, it could get 40% of its budget back, including visual effects work. You know, the UK is 20%. Those are big numbers.
Yeah, this is Lee Stranahan. I'll just mention too. I moved to New Mexico a year ago, and part of the reason I did is the film incentives here, which are 25%, are really good and very, very long term. I first started hearing about them years ago, and I agree completely with what Chris is saying. A lot of times, they drop them very quickly, and so when I first heard about them, I was like, I'm not interested. I figured they'll drop it. And now that I'm out here, I can tell you in this state, I don't think they'll drop them. And
no,
I think the reason is
New Mexico is not going anywhere. That's going
to. Yeah, no, it's not. And I think what's happened is it's gotten a lot of people to move out to the state. And the kind of people that they want to bring into economy, which is, you know, more affluent, educated.
Right, and arguably with transferable skill sets that could go to support other high-tech growth industries. And there's a good argument for it in the right kind of place. Certain places it doesn't make sense.
This is Scott. I think, you know, Jeff Oakenbutter brought up several good points, one of which was there's really no concerted effort on the part of the visual effects community to address this issue, whether it be here in the state of California, throughout various states in the United States, or even internationally. These things are being put together with really no lobbying effort, no concerted trade organization effort to be able to make sure that it benefits the visual effects community as well. And so I think that's another area where something like a trade organization could really have great effect.
Yeah, I think in hand in hand, you know, I was up in Vancouver recently meeting with them to talk about their steps and what they're taking. And I think one of the, just the small thing, like beginning to start talking about incentives as visual effects incentive, but rather an incentive for digital production. And I think just moving to begin to think of it like that, I think is a start of a help, because I think you have to begin to think that, wow, okay, and this is probably part of a larger point I'll try and make, which is that visual effects, even the idea that visual effects is a single line item on a budget of a feature film, is this kind of ghettoization of what has become really the most significant important tool that we use to make movies, which is, you know, digital technology. And I know certainly at Warner Brothers, we don't use the word visual effects as much as we try to use digital production. We try to talk about how in every single department on a movie, every line item on the movie, there's a digital component to it. All those are working through, you know, a single office often on a movie. So I think I guess the point I'm making is that as you begin to think about a lobbying organization or an initiative in California, I would begin to think about it in those terms.
Right.
All right, Jeff Oaken, anything on that one? I'll take it as another no, or that Jeff has died. So, Jeff Huser,
no,
the one who...
No, I'm here. Listen.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, this is a complex question, and, you know, what's being revealed is exactly the Rubik's Cube that we're dealing with. The cat's out of the bag, as I said before, and the issues before us now aren't as simple as they would appear to solve. And I want to, you know, make this point that, you know, the artist or the craftsperson, as I've been corrected, in some cases, you know, they're it. They do it. We're not interchangeable pieces, but we are interchangeable skill sets that can go from place to place to place, you know. And the future is an amazing place when you think about what it's going to be and how distribution is going to be done, and, you know, is there going to be a need for more or less visual effects work, or, you know, as Chris says, digital pipeline work, digital production work, and everybody here can answer that one. Yeah, there's going to be. The issue is that, and I think, Chris, I owe you this one, is that if you're doing business as usual, then you're not doing business anymore. You need to evolve, and you need to look to the future and see what it is that you can proactively and positively bring into the equation. That means that on a facility level, it may be generating your own content and dealing with your own distribution. It may be raising your own money and using traditional distribution. That may mean partnering up with a studio on a production and taking, you know, less money and asking for, you know, some points or something. On a individual artist level, you know, we don't get residuals. Puppeteers do, because they're in SAG, and even though we genuinely usually, and I'm not talking about Where the Wild Things Are, but other films I've worked on, we paint out the puppets and then we replace them, and the puppeteers still get residuals. Yeah, that's an inequity and something that needs to be dealt with. I know residuals are out of the question, and if you talk to the unions, they all say you're getting a residual, and that's what's copaying all your insurance and all this other stuff. But from an individual's viewpoint, you know, it's like, you know, when we were all little kids, they used to say that you vote with your dollars. And as an artist, you're voting with where you're choosing to work. And what's happened in the last 2 years, thanks to the worldwide economy crashing, is that people are losing that luxury. So you don't have the choice of where to work anymore. And you're putting your votes in places that treat you badly or don't have air conditioning or heat. Or I know, you know, down at Weta, they're working 102-hour weeks and sleeping under their desks, and, you know, people were making decisions about lifestyles and things like that. And as I scan these questions here that are coming in the Q&A, a lot of them are about, you know, can Warner Brothers pass a policy that says we're only going to hire companies that have, you know, heating, air conditioning, comfortable seats, and proper ventilation in them. You know, and that's sort of like out in left field. It's like, it's really not up to Warner Brothers to do that. It's up to us, the artists, to do that, to go make the stand. And yeah, it sounds like, even to me, it sounds like I'm trying to tell everybody as an individual, stand up for what you believe in. Make some noise. Don't stand by passive. If you don't know how to do business, you know, learn how to do business. It's important. Throughout history, artists have suffered because they don't know how to do business. And I think plugging the VES for a second is that, you know, the VES has a lot of plans to do that kind of education, and I believe everybody should join the VES that's an artist and join in. And I think that everybody that's here tonight, the 436 of you that are here at this moment, are doing a proactive thing because you're getting involved in the conversation, and it's the conversation that's going to make the change. But the change may not be what you think it's going to be. You know, the ball is rolling, and it can't ever go back to the way it used to be, as much as I dearly would like it to do that. When I used to take film after film and they would overlap by 2 weeks, you know, it's a rough thing out there. And there's a lot of ways to look at any financial equation, but in the end, it all comes down to your personal decision as to whether you can, you know, live with what you're accepting or not and what the alternatives are. A lot of people are leaving the industry because they just can't make a living in it. They're losing everything. A lot of people are leaving the industry because they can't stomach it anymore. These are personal choices that need to be made. But we on this panel right now, you know, we're here to foster a discussion about change. We're here to foster a discussion about what it is now in order that intelligent change can be made. And in the best of all worlds, as we plan, the discussion will continue beyond tonight, and hopefully directions, positive directions, and things that are doable can come forward. And when you add up all this stuff, again, you know, I speak to the artists. The artists' complaints are with the facilities, not with the studios. You know, and the facilities, they have some work to do. And by their own admissions, they have some work to do. You know, the things are a little out of hand. The costs of business is getting out of hand, and the profit from the business is, you know, getting out of hand in the other direction. So
there you go. The VES, I can say, is all behind fostering these kinds of discussions. And as they are a professional honorary society, they're precluded by law and by their incorporation papers from getting involved in collective bargaining and things like that, which is why I'm here as an individual instead of a representative of the VES. So there's some topics.
Well, it seems like a lot of the questions in the Q&A are particularly about what the artists can do and where's the hope for the artists and what can they do to do anything to improve the situation.
Well, this is Chris again saying that I'm going to go back to kind of highlight something I did say before. I mean, you have to think about what artistry is and what it means to be an artist and what it, you know, at its core is to be able to sign your work, to know your work is your work. I think looking forward, I think survival of the artist in this business, really in some respects, is to separate what is you're telling the artist from the technician, from the skilled laborer. I don't think there's anything anybody on this call can do about the inevitable maturation of this business into a world where, yes, there's a certain amount of work that is going to be low hurdle for entry, not entirely skilled, and not requiring the kind of artistry that fosters kind of compensation.
Yeah, but that's no different than in the camera department either, Chris.
No,
you know,
different.
You start as a loader,
but let me
and you work your way up to an artist if you're lucky.
That's exactly right. But I don't know that this, you know, I'm not sure that that works here or as works. But one thing you do point out when you talk about the camera department, I do think where opportunity, and this is, again, I'm coming from my perspective here. I look at and I'm listening to your problem as you describe it, Jeff. I'm thinking the opportunity for me, for what I see, if I were advising someone entering the business right now, I would start trying to look at how the work of digital production is in the work that used to all be contained in a larger facility is becoming somewhat decentralized, a little bit fragmented. I think that's a very good trend. The example that I might pull to in other areas of film businesses should think that there was a time when a studio would go to Western Scenic to order a set. And that they would construct the whole set and deliver it to the stage, build it, and walk away. And then people would shoot on that set. Well, obviously, over time, it became the idea of a large scenic shop became some outdated. There was a standardization of tools and techniques. There was an increasingly trained workforce, unionized, I admit, that was able to do that in a very short prep period. And you know what was born out of that was just the art department on a movie, which essentially is like a company that we start every time we start a movie. Now, I know that it's less technology intensive, less capital intensive, but there is something that can be learned from that, I think. I think that if I were, again, going back to advising somebody to enter the business right now, I'd say, look at the fragmentation here. Is there a role for someone with your skills as a CGI artist in the art department, in vehicles, in camera? I mean, that's where the real growth for the visual effects artist from your business is. You know, someone who can come along and become a digital art director who's working only in the art department, not working for a visual effects company, and not necessarily working in the, quote, visual effects department on the film. You know, is there a digital vehicles person? Because we rely on digital vehicles in all of our movies almost. Is there somebody who's a specialist in that, who can actually brand themselves and become valued in that area? So that's a trend that I would, you know, I see it coming. At Warner Brothers, we are starting to staff that way. We're starting to bring in digital art directors, skilled people in each of the different departments. It's a slow trend, but I think it's a promising trend for the artist.
That's great.
You know,
I think that's
a cool thing.
You know, what you think about what Chris just said, you know, it's a multi-vertical industry, visual effects is, you know, which is one of the reasons it's hard to get it represented because, you know, somebody's a compositor, somebody's a match mover, somebody's an IT guy, you know, somebody's a shader writer, so on and so forth. What Chris is discussing is actually an open door that's worth looking into where, you know, you don't go to work for the facility, but you go to work as your digital art director or a digital set designer, you know, or the digital cameraman or the digital lighting gaffer equivalent of that, you know, the digital grip building, you know, Kukuloruses and all that stuff. I mean, the possibilities of what the future is going to be, like I said before, is pretty stunning, you know. The issue is we always leave it to other people to define it, and then we fill it in.
after they've built the role. But, you know, as an industry, we're supposed to be very clever individuals on an individual level. None of us are a troop of robots, not even the tracker guys and the roto guys and the paint guys and ladies. You know, we're these individuals. We're really bright. We're really smart. We tackle something. We can see things in a way nobody else can see them. Where we fail is in our activism, in our means to get organized, in our ways to, you know, reach out with problem solving instead of looking and pointing out the problems, you know, solutions. We need to start tossing solutions around.
You do, but Jeff, part of it, I'm going to stay on this sort of the point we were just making, this Chris and Ken, which is that I think you're absolutely right, but I think there what's required to generate those kinds of solutions, to lead the business in the directions, whether it's the direction I was just articulating or some other one, is the idea of leaders. And I do think that you know, the person that devises, in my art department analogy, it's the production designer, right, who is in charge of knowing where the cool talent is, who's a great scenic painter, who's somebody that can do, you know, an awesome job with faux wood floors or whatever. I think similarly, you know, I would look to visual effects supervisors maybe starting to think about their role in a little more expanded way. Maybe that's the place where leadership comes, where when Jeff, you know, you and I work together, when you come and we hire you on a movie, we sit down and instead of worrying about immediately where are we going to bid this work, who's got a great tax deal, let's talk about how could we staff the entire show using artists that you know, mm-hmm. in a way that could really maximize the use of digital tools and the efficiency that could come with that, as well as the artistry. I mean, you know, I've joked about this sometimes. I get a kick out of the idea that of a visual effects line item on a budget, there's a department called visual effects, which, you know, on a bad day is like calling something the Department of Hammers. That on a movie, if everything you had to use a hammer for, you had to go to one department, whereas anything else could be done using, but whenever it came to hammers, you got to go there. Well, I'm starting to feel it's a little bit like that with our movies now. Anytime you got to use digital, you got to go to this visual effects department, which is down the hall on the right, you know, near the editorial. And I think we've got to break that up a bit. I think it's good for the business. It's good to create employment. And I think, when I look at it that way, I could see a much healthier work environment coming out of that.
Yeah, this is Scott. I still look at it from the point of view of the facilities, and maybe I've not been in the business in the last 3 years, but it seems to me that the majority of the work are coming from visual effects facilities. And while there's an opportunity for a digital set designer or a digital lighter or a digital vehicles person or maybe a few digital vehicles persons on a film, the majority of the people that are working in visual effects and digital effects are hundreds of people that are working at facilities. And to be able to actually get the work done with pipeline and tools and software and technology, one needs a visual effects facility to be able to do that. And so I think it goes right back to how does the visual effects facility act in a way that's appropriate to its employees to be able to give them the opportunities that they need and the tools that they need? Because at the end of the day, that's what a visual effects facility is.
It is, but Scott, what visual effects facilities are selling me now when they come in the door? Yeah, let's stipulate going in, of course, you're absolutely right. The majority of employment comes in there, and I was never suggesting that a model we're describing here would, you know, account for 1,200 jobs working on the next Spider-Man or something. But if you look at where visual effects companies, at least what they're coming in the room right now and selling me, they're selling me their ability to not do work in the U.S., their ability to relocate employees, pipeline, or to partner with companies in India to get our work done cheaper. That's the new sales pitch. Nobody is selling me Nobody is selling me on artistry as much as they're selling me on economy that comes from internationalizing.
See, and I guess, Chris, I think they're going in the wrong direction. What they need to be doing is they need to be selling the opportunity that if you want Davy Jones in your movie, there's really only a handful of places to be able to do it. The highest quality work comes from a handful of places.
The commodity
work comes from elsewhere.
Right, but most of these companies, the facilities, and I think the future for facilities is interesting, is a word I'll use. I think they are, the commodity work we all know is moving out, right? I mean, if we get a bid from, it doesn't matter what company, the major companies, you know, they include in their bid how much of the work is going to be done not, you know, in U.S. soil or not at their central facility. Would I look at the companies there? And if I were at a magic wand, I mean, there's a vision of facilities here, and you know, I'm sure it's not correct, but at least strikes me as somewhat commonsensical, which is that the R&D of the facilities, you know, their ability to advance technology, that's something that, as a consumer of visual effects, I can say we're willing to pay for and pay dearly for. A signature effect in a movie, something that solves how, you know, Spider-Man moves, how Harry Potter's wand works or something. That there's no price too high. It's just, you know, whatever can be the coolest. The fall off is pretty dramatic after that, right? Once you get past those, you know, the work beyond that, you're not going to ever step up to the level you would for that signature work. We know that. The other thing that I'm willing to pay for is sound production management and a creative framework which can allow us to do the work. And the sound production management is the ability to maintain and set up a pipeline for doing what you said, getting those 800 shots out the door. I see companies now, you know, the future I see for companies is to emphasize those things that I just listed off, to be a company that has an awesome, incredible, transportable pipeline, you know, with incredibly sophisticated and robust production management tools, to have rate in, you know, staff artists to help, you know, and then a very, very you know, thriving research and development arm that can bring technical innovation. Now, after that, those are the things I pay for. How they go about executing that, yeah, that's the facilities business, which I don't know, and that may require, obviously, a home base, a significant employment, you know, in whatever, in Marin County or in Marina del Rey. Or it may be a smaller group like that, and the most of it being in a tax incentive-rich environment or in a low labor market.
Now, Chris, let me ask you something. I want to clarify something. You said when the facilities come, they're bidding you on price, basically, and their ability to...
No, they're not leading with price. Let me be fair. They are the new sales pitch, the one I hear every day now, is, you know, of course it is look at the reel, look at the artistry, look at what we're capable of doing. But the real new lead line, the one that we really get, is their ability to work in low labor markets and to pass those savings on to us, or to work in tax incentive rich. I mean, look at who's opening up in Vancouver. I mean, who's not opening up in Vancouver? You got UK companies and Los Angeles companies all moving there. You've got Sony, DD, MPC, CIS, who am I forgetting, and Prime Focus operating there.
The Digital Domain, too.
And DD, I think it's, yeah.
Isn't this a circle, though? Isn't that also to meet the request of the studios for that?
I haven't asked anybody to go work in Canada.
Well, actually, that's what I was going to ask, Chris. I was going to say, okay, so if that's what they're leading with,
yeah.
Are you saying that's what you say? Do you think they're doing that because they think that's what you want? And do they, if you know, you as the studio, and if so, why do they think that? If you're saying you haven't asked anyone to do it,
well, I'm not sure I'm not sure where this is going, where that conversation. But I'll try and answer your question. I mean, they say that because they realize that they can bring their price down by working there, and that they feel the pressure coming from competent new companies in those low labor markets or incentive rich environments. So that's what they perceive as the answer. I don't actually ask that as the question. I don't say, hey, are you operating in Canada? I say, that sounds great. How's the work? You know, can we get this great work? Can we get it into the budget we need to get this into? I don't, you know, I'm not pressing anybody to work anywhere far from home, and I'm tired of getting on airplanes, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, it seems like, you know, pricing is obviously one of those big, big three issues in business. And, I read something very recently where they were saying that, you know, once you get into those competitive pricing wars, in any business, sandwich shop or visual effects, you're in real trouble.
That's the biggest thing. I couldn't agree more, which is why I kind of come back to the point I hope I'm making tonight, which is that you got to get out of that cycle. What is a commodity has to be left to be a commodity. What is determined by price alone, and for which branding carries no value, is a crazy thing to chase.
you know, that's a losing game. But in Hollywood, the deals we make are the deals that are crazy, the ones for which there's no ceiling, are deals for talent. You know, and while I don't think, you know, we'll ever get to the kind of crazy above-the-line deal-making that goes on Hollywood movie and visual effects, I do think trying to emphasize what is unique, trying to carve out what's unique, what can be viewed as talent, what is there not a just a, you know, as you said, just a price-driven negotiation. That's the place to go if I were a facility, I'm saying. That's where I would be looking.
So from a facility's perspective, you know, the issue is that the facilities have a sense of that we have to deliver incredible high quality, an incredible pipeline, and the ability to be, you know, robust, so that when a director comes back 8 weeks before the delivery of a show and has 300 shots, we're capable of doing it. But in addition to that, we've suffered under that we have to, we bid so aggressively against each one of us. And so there are a handful of large facilities that do that signature work. Commodities work is commodities work, and I think that commodities work is going to suffer from a similar kind of situation. You know, as we look overseas, we'll see the big shops in India doing commodities work, then we'll see the big shops in India doing more signature work, then we'll see smaller shops in India doing more commodities work for less margins, and it'll continue. It'll happen very quickly.
Yeah.
But the mindset of the facility's owner is, I got to get the planes in the air, and so I'm going to do it for whatever it takes, because I know the guy down the street is going to do it for 5% less than me, and he has the ability to do it. So everybody's so concerned about delivering the highest quality and being able to deliver it on time, but at the lowest possible price. And so it's a mixed-up commodity issue. It's great barriers to entry, incredible value, more value than we've ever seen in the industry. We just look at box office. And cutthroat competitive pricing amongst people that deliver branded, high-quality work.
How is that different from 30 years ago, though, Chris? I mean, Scott?
That's true. It's not. It's really not. And what we've seen, though, 30 years ago, we've seen people fall and die and fall and die and fall and die. But what's happened now is that the work is so critical. You know, 30 years ago, from a studio perspective, the studio was saying, yeah, it'd be great to be able to have really nice effects on E.T., but it was Steven that was saying that. And the studio and the distributors were concerned about who the movie star was. You know, if I have Sylvester Stallone in my movie, I can open it in 15 territories, and that's what it was about. But the parameters of that have changed now. We're not seeing movie stars open movies anymore. We're seeing trailers open movies, and trailers with incredible visuals.
Now, Chris, the idea of a trade group has come up a couple of times. From a studio perspective, how does that make you feel?
I have no problem with that. I have no problem with it. With whatever organization could, again, if it's going to lead to a healthy business, right? To advancements in artistry, you know, I'm all for it. You know, as I say, we I know it sounds like easy to say, but I can speak for all the studios when I say we need these artists and these companies to be thriving. You know, we need that. If that's what points to, sure. I don't have any issue with that. Why would we? Because you think it'll drive the price up?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that it's that traditional idea that everybody, that's what I sort of said at the beginning. I don't view there's villains in this. But I think everybody has that traditional view that there's adversarial relationships. And so I just sort of wanted to try to get you on record talking about, like, how, because I think a lot of people would assume, you know, and again, that's why I'm really, really glad that I forget someone who said it, but they were like, well, I understand why people would come out and talk about this from the workers, you know, the workers' perspective, the artist's perspective. I understand why people would talk about it from the facility, but they're like, what's in it for Chris DeFaria? Like, why is he talking about it? And I think you summed it up really well as the studio, a thriving visual effects industry is really important to you guys.
Of course, it has to be. I mean, it's so funny because I think it's funny that the question's ever raised, what possible interest could we have in making it all work better? That's interesting. I think, I mean, we're deeply invested. I mean, you know, we the Harry Potter franchise, you know, was built an industry in a country. You know, we did that, you know, we the success of that was critical to the success of that franchise. So our fortunes are intertwined here. And I don't think, if I can get one thing across tonight, I hope it's that. So when you mention the options, I mean, the options that I'm suggesting here are not options that, or even the perspective I'm bringing here is not as self-serving as you might suspect. It's you know, it's one of those funny things, like when a movie from another studio opens and does $100 million on the weekend, we're happy, even if it's another studio. We love the idea of $100 million openings out there. We love the idea of people going to the movies. We love the idea of a thriving business. And that same logic extends down to, you know, the companies we're in business with, especially these companies that have proved to be such partners in delivering these amazing, you know, the amazing work that you're talking about tonight.
Well, and I think, too, it's obvious that people in their lives, you know, you don't eat the lowest price food just because it's the lowest price food. You sometimes you do, but mostly you eat food that you think is good for you and that you like. And the film industry doesn't just, it doesn't lowball on everything. Otherwise, films would be filled with completely unknown actors because it's obvious they're obviously a lot cheaper to hire than name actors. So I think this idea that I think you summed it up well. People aren't used to pricing on value, and when they get scared and nervous, they immediately go to, well, we can do it cheaper. And it really is a race to the bottom, unfortunately. But Jeff Huser, any questions you want to throw into the mix?
I was just sitting here thinking that I kind of expected this to this whole town hall to. I thought Chris would get more beat up, but it sounds to me like the facilities and the artists themselves are the ones that are getting most beat up here, and probably rightfully so. That, you know, it seems pretty clear to me that we need a global guild of some sort, and somebody, so people have some business representation that maybe we're not good at, as somebody pointed out.
But do you mean artists, an artist guild, or an industry organization representing?
Well, both. I think like Jeff said, both are important. But I think that it's clear that both have to be global somehow. I don't know how that works, but you know, there's a lot of comments. A lot of the comments are about, you know, the global concerns of this. You know, and everybody talks about guild immediately. The first thing they say is, well, that won't work because it's a global, you know, business, and work will just run out of the United States, for example. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like the fingers are pointed pretty directly toward the artists themselves, not, you know, representing themselves well enough in what they're willing to work, conditions they're willing to work under, and in the facilities.
Well, let me speak up for artists, Jeff, since I allegedly have beat them up a little bit. Look, everybody just wants to get along. You know, I get a thrill out of what it is I'm allowed to do, and unfortunately, you know, the canvas I have to work on usually is a motion picture or a television show or a commercial, nothing I can afford to fund myself. Every artist, you know, they do this out of love. And, you know, that is both our wonderful thing, you know, that's what makes them, you know, that's what makes you pay $18,000 for a shot and get an $80,000 shot out of it, because each artist has their individual tastes, and they're supported by fantastic people, you know, the paint and roto people and the IT people and the shaders and all the people that usually don't get recognized, which is, as an aside, a little bit of what the VES Awards is about. But at the same time, you know, as you get older, when, you know, when you have a family, when you're, you know, you got kids going to schools and things like that, then suddenly money becomes a huge issue. And the issue is, and it's traditional, and it's not unique to visual effects workers, the issue is as a human being, you know, what you're willing to do to get your foot in the door and really have a lot of fun and feel some sense of fulfillment inside you is what you're willing to do later on in life. Conditions change, and suddenly there's a machine to feed. There's mortgages and houses to buy and kids to put in school and all that stuff, and then things change. And it's that point
that people reach when they go, wait a minute here, you know, this isn't fair, and this should be different, and this should be different, and that should be different. And it's really hard to look at all the students that are graduating out of these schools and showing up bright-eyed. And if everybody that's on this conference has been doing this for more than 10 years, think about your first few days when you really got to be to the place you were. There was always a handful of those cynical older guys going, yeah, yeah, you know, and it's a struggle not to become one of them. And that's, you know, what I'm trying to do. I do a lot of talks at Noman School about career realities and things. And what I try to pass off to each of the artists is the future is your own. Yes, there's an industry. Yes, there's a form to work within. And yes, there's a lot of bad practices out there and really sucky conditions. But your future is your own. If you want to make money, I say to them, why are you in this business? You know, there are businesses about making money. You know, they're called investment bankers and, you know, all those stock people that have just raped the country and mortgaging guys and all that stuff. You know, this industry is more about making a living wage. And when the artists and the technicians and the craftspeople are saying, I can't make a living wage, then we have a real problem. And with the crash of the economy, with the commoditization of our tools and our art set, and, you know, I know we have a lot of people from around the world on this call, but think about this. We're outsourcing not just the work. We're outsourcing our specific and unique abilities. There's a lot of people in China that have been hired to go over and teach them the American way of doing visual effects and managing a project. There's a lot of people in India, you know. And what we're really doing is we're training the whole world to work as we are. So in a sense, got to take responsibility for our own actions, you know. It's like, what was your plan other than to line your pocket and make a living wage in the short term? What were you going to do 10 years from now, you know, when you're 40 or 50 or whatever it is? So the solution to this may or may not be a union and may or may not be a guild. But I go back to this other thing, the one thing that we can do. The solution to this is speak up and be heard. This town hall, again, is a great thing. You know why? Because you're talking and we're hearing you. Ideas are being shared. The Visual Effects Society is starting a web forum thing, you know, trying to foster this very kind of discussion and looking for a way to support Lee to keep the discussion going. You know, that's what's important, because out of the discussion coalesces a plan. And one of the plans, and I quote Jonathan Erland here, who, you know, the VES gave him a Founders Award 4 years ago, and he says that his point of view is that it takes three legs of a chair to be stable. One of them is the honorary society, one of them is a guild, and one of them is a trade organization. You know, it's I'm not a socialist, but I think it's a little bit of a time for some socialism to be used amongst the industry people. You know, and I feel that capitalism has failed us to a certain degree because, and I know all the artists are thinking this, because when is enough profit enough profit? You know, but the way that the system works right now for us, for the artists, for the practitioners, for the people that are feeding the animal, I go back to something that Chris said a long time ago that I've quoted already, is if you're doing business as usual, you're not doing business. And it's time to think about the future instead of how you did it last week. It's time to get creative. It's time to get vocal. If you don't have the business skills, hire an agent, hire an attorney, or learn. It's time for you to sit down and evaluate yourself and what it is that you are in this for. You know, society doesn't owe anybody a living. But the artists, man, the artists, we are the future, the digital artists, and by that I mean the craftspeople and all the other people that go into putting a single pixel from, you know, position here, XY11, to position XY22. I'm talking about all the people involved, is that we control the future. We've seen it. Our budgets are often, you know, the major part of the project that you're working on, but you don't have equal say in it, you know, and there's a reason for it. Things have evolved, and if you want that say in it, that means, you know, it's maybe time for you to step up and take some reins. I've noticed as an industry-wide tradition that I believe that all of us are directors and writers and producers and editors and production managers, and that when I get a project, I know that it's a lot about selling, hearing what the director and the producer and the studio want, and then going off to the artist crowd and then reworking the whole thing, doing our boards and our animatics and coming back and pitching it to the director, and you know, they'll thumbprint it, or some directors actually will take charge and say, no, I want this or that. But the point is when they present it to the studio, when they present it to the producers, when they present it to the public, we take one giant step back as an industry and we fade into the fog, you know. And again, I can't drive this point home enough, is that it's not their responsibility to shine a light on me. When Chris hires me to do a movie, Chris is hiring me to do a job that he hired me for. That's the beginning of it, the middle of it, and the end of it. He didn't hire me to go out and do interviews. He didn't hire me to go out and go, it was me who did all this. Look at how creative I am. That's up to me as an individual. And so as artists, you know, it may be the time for all of us to start going, yeah, okay, working at Digital Domain is my day job, but my passion is X. I'm going to write and direct a movie, or I'm going to, you know, record an album, and I'm going to build a house, whatever it is. You need to sit down and look at yourselves and figure out what it is that empowers you, and then you need to take the risks in order to be able to do it. And if that means standing up for working rights in the workplace, man, we need people to stand up for those rights. If nobody says anything except for whispers in the kitchen behind people's backs, how do you expect it to change? Are we all waiting for the silver armored guy on the white horse to come around? And you know, I'm looking at what John Detz just wrote in his question about innovation. You know, we are the innovators. It's up to us. And it goes back to my favorite Shakespeare play, Julius Caesar. And it goes back to the quote in that play where Cassius is talking to Brutus, and the fault here, the fault is in ourselves that we are underlings. That's where it is. So we got to stand up, take inventory, and then take responsibility for yourself. And then when you go and interface with your facility and interface with your studio and interface with your thing, you know, if you have a point of view and you have the strength to make it, you'll be making it from a solid point. And change will come. But I don't think, you know, that the studio is the bad guy. I don't think the facility is the bad guy. I think that, you know, we just haven't been smart as we think we are over the years to evolve things the way they needed to be evolved. And again, I'll tip my hat to Scott Ross, because 30 years ago, I know what he tried to do. And he was vilified for it 30 years ago. But as it turns out, it was the right thing to do. Nobody took him up on it. So that's the end of my rant.
I have a question for the other two panelists. So, you know, we're really in the middle of a perfect storm. Chris DeFaria, Art Rapola, their counterparts are doing a fantastic job. They're doing everything that the industry, their bosses are telling them to do, and they're doing it better than I've ever seen it before, which is put out world-class movies with incredible images that knock the socks off of box office and do it as reasonably priced and on time as they can do it. And they're doing it in a way that I've never, ever seen before. So the question is, in the middle of this perfect storm, what is the one solution, just one, because we could go off in tangents, what is the one suggestion that we would have to be able to address the concerns of the visual effects artists so that their work is recognized, that they're paid fairly, that as the industry is graying, they spend time with their families and their kids, and they have health and support and things like that. What is the one thing that we could do to make this a better place?
That's for you. That's for Chris and Jeff Hogan.
Yeah,
I'm thinking.
Well,
the one,
you know, what
thing
can we do to make this a better place? You know, one thing is that we could, you know, understand how we fit into the picture and begin to act accordingly. And that means that, you know, I'd love to see more mentoring going on. I would like to see less ladder climbing and more working your way you know, into a position in learning it so that you're not a specialist in one thing, but you can do it, you know, you know what you're doing, you know, from all aspects of the coin. I'd like to see a more open dialogue, you know, within the industry.
The one thing that if there was one thing, and it's a general answer, it would be to find the leverage that you have in the business, because it's just impossible to accomplish any of what is being described here, the goals being described here, without operating from a position of strength and leverage. And I do think many industries, and I fear the visual effects business, has a way of ignoring its strong hand. And sometimes undermining it in short-sightedness. I think that seems to be not a common mistake made by many companies in many industries, but I don't see a lot of that here. Whether that leverage is association with a powerful director or filmmaker, whether that leverage is innovation in business practices and technology, whether that leverage is the ability to understand intimately and quickly the needs of a particular project or a film, and then present solutions that you own. That's what I don't hear in the call, and I don't know how a business can change without that, without somebody either in leadership or a group or a trade organization or a guild or a loose organization or the participants of a phone call, simply beginning to look back and say, look, what is the hand we're dealt? What are the cards we have? That are unique and that are powerful and that can be used to change the economic structure that is this race to the bottom.
Well, you know, Chris, one thing I'm seeing with questions that I think I know the answer, but just based on a guess about business, is that a few people are saying basically like, when was the last time Warner Brothers didn't take a low bid? So I think the assumption is that the visual effects studios put in bids to you, and then you look at the lowest one, and that's what you go with. Is that correct?
I guess any idiot could do this job. Then no, of course it's not correct. How could someone mentioned on the call, and I think everybody has to agree that the quality of work being done is as high or higher than it's ever been done before. I mean, we don't. If that's the product of our chasing the lowest bid, then yes, this business is in deep trouble. It's not that at all. We take pride, I certainly take pride, and I'm sure my counterparts do at other studios, in trying to really place a show or a shot or a sequence at the right place. There's no doubt that the prices have to be competitive, but there's a show we're bidding right now where we've gone back in two instances, and if there's representatives of those companies on the phone, they'll know. And we've said, we think you're too low here. We don't think you fully understand what we're after in this particular sequence. So, and that's happened with two major companies in the last 2 weeks. It happens a lot. What we try very hard to do, certainly at Warner Brothers, is really drill down on what we're looking for so that when we sit down with a company to talk about it or we put it out to bid, that it's really accurate, so that when we do end up taking a competitive bid, you know, we're putting it, we're the people that are left in the competition at that point are qualified to do the work and do it at a very high level. I mean, we're in the business, certainly at Warner Brothers, we want our movies to be something no one's ever seen before. You know, listen, that doesn't always work out, and we make bad movies like everybody else does, but we never set out to do that. We set out to make something that's ass-kicking, something that no one's ever seen, something that's spectacular. And so that's a long way of saying, no, when's the last time Warner Brothers didn't take the lowest bid? I would say, when's the last time Warner Brothers took the lowest bid? We just don't do
that. Right. I mean, I think that, like I say, that's really part of the reason for this discussion, is because I think that if you're an in-the-trenches, hands-on-buttons visual effects artist, you don't have any idea, really. You wouldn't. Why would you know what someone like Chris DeFari is going through in making the decision? And I think that one of my old mentors used to say that in the absence of information, people usually assume the worst. And I think that you know, that's just a truism that basically when people don't know things, it's always easiest to go, oh, I haven't, you know, Jeff Okun didn't answer. He's probably dead. So, or something like that. So I think that that was really one of the reasons I wanted to put this together was to get someone like Chris saying, no, it's not just the lowest bid. It's who can do the job. And there might be 3, 4, or 5 companies who can do the job, and then pricing might be a factor, but I assumed it wasn't the overriding factor, and I think a lot of people assume differently. But I know I could ask the same question to Scott Ross. How often did you hire someone at DD? Did you just hire on the basis of the cheapest person for the job, or did you occasionally go, well, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not the way people do things.
Hey, Lee.
So, I mean, I assume if we ask Scott, he used to hire the more expensive person in any number of cases because they were the right person.
Lee?
Yeah.
So I'd like to take a shot at that question, which is, listen, of course, Chris and any other executive at any major studio is looking for the best possible work, the ability to be able to deliver, to offer some visual effects that is incredibly compelling, that puts butts in the seats. And they're looking to get that at the lowest reasonable price that they can. And that's their job. And they do it really, really well. 25 years ago, Jeff mentioned, 25 years ago or so, I tried to start a group called the Association of Visual Effects Creators. And I put together a group, a round table of the major facilities to come together. And unfortunately, everybody was so paranoid of everything, it was difficult for anybody to sit at the table and each look at each other because they looked at each other as the enemy. You were stealing my job from me, or you were taking my employee from me. But that time has got to end. And what has to happen now is there needs to be a trade organization that represents the industry in government, with the studios, through tax incentives, through marketing and advertising, a trade organization that represents the visual effects community that can allow people to make a decent wage and get paid correctly, a trade organization that brings better business practices to facilities who are traditionally not run by business people. And what does it lack? It lacks what it always lacked, what everything lacks, which is the only way to be successful is to have leadership. And if there's no one who stands up with leadership and say, this is our charter, this is what we're going to do, this is the effort, and has the support of the entire industry, it'll never get done.
Well, we're close to about the time that we should be wrapping this up. So let me just, if anyone has any final things to say, that was a stirring little bit from Scott Ross there. But Jeff or Chris, anything you'd like to end with?
I'm really on the side of artists. I know it doesn't sound like it. That's what I'd like to say.
Jeff. I think what you're saying is artists need to take responsibility for themselves, and I think that that's a pro. I don't think that that's against artists at all. I think that that's accurate.
Thank you.
I don't think that's anti-artist at all. It's if you're not taking responsibility, and in that same sense, like Scott's saying, the facilities also have to take responsibilities for themselves. In the same way, the studios have the MPAA, and I don't see them moving to disband that anytime soon. I think that you have other. Visual effects artists are operating in an environment where most other people who work on films already are standing basically on the shoulders of the people who did take responsibility. And, any actor now is protected by the people who formed SAG decades ago. I think that's the advantage they have, is that if you're an actor coming into the industry now, a lot of work's been done for you, basically. There's already an infrastructure that protects your rights. And it's the same thing if you're building sets or if you're a transpo driver. There's already a structure in place. And visual effects artists just haven't had that. So I don't think you're beating up on anyone too much, Jeff.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Chris, any last words from you?
No, I just listening to all the things, a lot of provocative things on the table here. I do think, you know, I'm trying to imagine if a trade organizations are really obviously a smart idea, a lobbying organization that can try and affect the macro business, you know, that exists out here for visual effects. Idea of a guild that could, I think the guild is something that would be bear more relevance with conversations with the vendors who do most of the hiring. Having a studio sign on, in a sense, with a guild saying they'll only use vendors that recognize the guild, that's the place you want to get to. It seems like a long place from where we are. But you have to start down a road. And that's so, you know, whoever's idea is out there, what the first step to doing that is, you know, I think that's it's a smart first step. Beyond that, you know, I think you have to, though, on a short-term basis, really look at, if someone says, I can't make any money in my business, and I'm talking about a company, then you kind of say, you're not doing it right. I mean, you know, you can't, the forces that affect that are not there either, that there's no market for your work, or you're not pricing your work to reflect the market. I mean, that's kind of old school stuff, but I think, you know, someone has to look at that. If you're an artist and you're going to go work at a place that keeps you up all night long, this is Jeff's point, and make you work, you know, on Saturdays without compensation, I'm not sure who's to blame. How can you blame the company for that? You know, you took the job. So there's personal responsibility. There's responsibility of these companies to manage themselves better. You know, of course, there's responsibility for the studios to support an industry. And I like to think we do that. You know, I'm sure most people on this call think we could do a better job than that. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
Well, that's great. Let me finish up. I want to thank everyone on the panel, Jeff, Chris, and Scott. I really, really appreciate it. And I want to thank Jeff Huser for helping me navigate through the questions, which are hard to read and screw up the slides at the same time, which I was able to do. And I really want to thank everyone here for attending and all your interest. If anyone's interested in the next town hall event, if you're on the mailing list for this, I will let you know. You can also check vfxfairness.com. I'm sure Jeff and the FX Guide will let you know. I'm sure Brian and Motionographer will let you know as well. But we'll be doing a mail out. It won't happen before NAB. That much I can tell you. So the next one will probably be about 3 weeks into April. That's the best guess I can give you right now. But until next time, I really appreciate everyone showing up, and everyone have a great night.
Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Lee.
And Chris and Scott.
Thank you all.
Good night.
Okay, good night, everyone.